Hey folks, Sam Cedar here. You're listening to a free version of the Ring of Fire Radio podcast. If you want the total show without commercials, head over to ROFpodcast.com and become a member of this program. Look, this is our main source of revenue for Ring of Fire Radio, and you can help keep us on the air by signing up for a Ring of Fire podcast membership. For far less than a cup of coffee a week, you can support this program and get our full show. Head over to ROFpodcast.com right now and sign up. Much appreciated. Welcome to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. Today on Ring of Fire, John Nichols from The Nation magazine will join us to discuss why Steve Bannon's White House exit doesn't erase the stain left on the Trump presidency. Arthur Delaney from The Huffington Post will be here to explain why bad jobs and cuts in welfare led to the rise of a new charity called the Diaper Bank. Heather Digby Parton from Salon.com will be here to help boil down what was a very busy week in news. And America's lawyer, Mike Papantonio, will stop by to talk about his upcoming book and give us an update on some of the big cases he's been working on this year. Folks, don't forget, you can go to ROFpodcast.com and sign up for the free one-hour version of the Ring of Fire Radio podcast. And if you want the full show without commercials, become a member. That's the best way to support this program. That's ROFpodcast.com. Here to help recap the big week in news, Heather Parton from Salon, or as you may know her from her blog, Hullabaloo, Digby. So, Digby, of course, another week in the Trump era, one without Steve Bannon. Now he is obviously gone, but not forgotten there on his perch at Breitbart. And we should also say there was a total eclipse of the sun, at least for parts of the United States this week. Donald Trump looked at the sun no less than six times. It was recorded without his glasses. As far as we can tell, no ill effects on the president, although the baseline for that statement is pretty low to begin with. So hard to say. Let's talk about the other, sort of at least major policy announcement, I guess. And that was part of it is in the, it seems to me that in an attempt, at least partially, to get out from under the reverberations of the president's reaction to neo-fascists, to fascists marching in Charlottesville, he announced a major policy pronouncement speech for Monday night on our, I guess, in occupation, I don't know what else to call it, of Afghanistan. And it turned out to be not particularly major. Was it or wasn't it? I can't tell, to be honest with you.
Well, considering the fact that he gave us absolutely zero details on what this, you know, major announcement was supposed to announce, it's kind of hard to tell. I mean, there were some, you know, we knew that they had, that they, back in June, they had already announced that they were sending more troops to Afghanistan. And that kind of just was one of those things that sort of fell under the radar. They sort of presented it as being something kind of temporary. They needed to do it. And then, of course, we know he dropped the mother of all bombs on Afghanistan earlier in the year as well, which he was very proud of because it made a big go boom and he really liked that.
Did we find out what that was about? I mean, honestly, like, was it they just dropped it in the middle of nowhere, right?
Yeah. I mean, apparently, you know, there was some rationale for it that, you know, nobody really understood as far as I can tell. I think they just wanted to drop it. And I think that part of it is that, you know, this is part of Trump's demonstration of power thing, right? You know, he wants to show, because then they'll never mess with us again. That's, you know, that's the extent of his military strategy. I mean, he reiterated what he had said during the campaign about, you know, wanting to, you know, keep everything a secret. I mean, to him, the only military strategy that exists is a surprise attack. That's the only one that he understands. And so he says, I can't really tell you anything that we're going to do here, because if I do, that will be giving information to the enemy. So no deadlines, no troop numbers, no anything. Now, he's going to run into problems because the Congress has to approve all that stuff. So, you know, he may have to let the cat out of the bag at some point. But the entire speech was really just this vague, you know, and it was obviously written by somebody other than him. I mean, there was language in there that I'm sure it's the first time Trump's ever heard of it. And, you know, there was some stuff about how we're not going to take it from Pakistan anymore, and there's no blank check, and we're not going to do nation building, and blah, blah, blah. I mean, these are all things that we've heard from other presidents. Even President Obama said many of the same things, you know, in a slightly more coherent fashion than Trump did. So, you know, essentially, I think you're right. I mean, there was this idea that the from the time Trump came in, that they were going to reassess the strategy in Afghanistan, which is a, you know, that's a logical thing, a new
perfectly reasonable
then, of
to,
course, and,
yes.
And we should. And there had been a big battle with the military and with some of the outside advisors, including Steve Bannon, on what that, you know, new strategy should be, which we can talk about. But, you know, this was going to happen anyway, and it doesn't sound like they've come up with anything. I mean, we don't know, again, no details, but assuming that what we hear from the leaks and the various reports in the press, this is really kind of more of the same. And it's the only thing that's changed now is that Trump has taken total ownership of Afghanistan. He can
right.
no longer kibitz. And that's one of the things I think the generals in the Pentagon, Mattis in particular, had really wanted to do, because Trump has a bad habit of blaming other people for everything. And I think
right.
they wanted to make sure that Trump went out and made a big speech and basically, you know, took ownership of this new policy so that he couldn't turn around and say that it was all Mattis's fault or McMaster or who, or the commander in Afghanistan. He knew what he was saying. He said that it was, he'd studied it, like, right. And that he understood what he was doing there and that he had signed off on it. So, you know, that I mean, that's all I know. I don't know about you.
I think that last one is a fascinating and really important observation. The idea that, and if we look at the trajectory, we can see how this worked, right? They brought Jared, the son-in-law, to, I guess it was, to Afghanistan and maybe to Iraq as well,
mm-hmm.
put on a flak jacket over his sport coat. And spent some time making him feel, I think, butch and macho. And this was part of the project. And that makes total sense to me, that from the perspective of the military, they don't want to be Donald Trump's scapegoat. They don't want to be a force in which, you know, Donald Trump is running against the military in some respect, or making them out to be this deep state. And I mean, I'm not saying that I have a particular love of the military as an institution. Obviously, I think we need one, but you know, I'm a little concerned at the prospect of a series of generals making our policy. And to some extent, I mean, this is something that we also understood about Donald Trump, is that he had early on said, I'm basically outsourcing any hard decisions to the military.
Right.
And that's where that 4,000 troop number came from. I mean, and we got to take a break here, but I want to ask you that. I mean, it does seem on some level, although this was, you know, there's sort of debates about Afghanistan ongoing, and you wrote about the four soldiers who came in to talk to Donald Trump. We'll talk about that. But I wonder, I want to come back, I want to talk about the specific, to the extent that there were any, because largely it seems to me the speech was, I have a secret plan for Afghanistan, obviously I can't tell you or it wouldn't be secret, and I just wanted you all to know that. But it also seems to me that the question is whether or not this was just a head fake. You know, it's just a way of like resetting, changing the subject. But if it does have any implications in terms of our foreign policy, I think there's one or two things in the speech that stuck out for me that I think indicate what's happening. But I don't know how new it is for the Trump administration. We shall see when we return. We're talking to Heather Parton. I'm Sam Cedar. This is Ring of Fire Radio. We'll be right back after this.
Can you even see what you're fighting for? Bloodlust and a holy war. Listen up, hear the patriots shout. Times are changing. In the end, my choice was clear. Take a shot in the face of fear. Fist up.
I'm a trial lawyer. I've spent countless hours poring through documents that tell the story about the ugliest side of corporate America.
Fraud.
Corporate media refuses to talk about these issues.
The conduct by this company was deplorable.
I'm going to paint a clear picture about how disturbing, how corrupt corporate conduct has become in modern America. These are stories that no one else can tell. I'm Mike Papantonio, host of America's Lawyer. Question more.
Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar here with Heather Digby Parton from Salon. So Heather, when we broke, you had made the point that to a large extent, what we saw this week with Donald Trump announcing, and I'm going to do air quotes here, a new policy in Afghanistan. And I'm putting the air quotes actually around new and the word policy. So two sets of air quotes. because I think both of those things need to be examined. And I think they're both arguable, frankly. But what the military definitely got was Donald Trump taking ownership of what we're doing in Afghanistan. It is now his Afghanistan policy, regardless of the fact that that policy may not actually even be a policy. I mean, he got up there, he said, I've got a secret plan. Of course, I can't tell you about it because that would tip the hand. But believe me, it's going to be devastating. And then he also said a couple of things that we have heard before multiple times. He said, we're not going to leave based on a timetable. We're only going to leave based upon conditions on the ground. And he said, this is a new thing that we've developed and, you know, a new concept. But George Bush said that over a decade ago, in 2006, in a speech I think he gave in March, at the very least. I mean, this is just literally off the top of my head. John McCain said this in the run-up of the 2008 election. We're still not out of Afghanistan. On top of him saying we're only going to leave when there's conditions, he never told us what those conditions were. In fact, he went on to say, we're not going to impose anything on Afghanistan society. They're going to have to deal with that. We're just going to kill terrorists, he said. So it sort of like demands the question to be asked, what are the conditions? What's left? I mean, the complete absence of terrorists? I don't understand.
Honestly, I don't know what he's talking about. This is something that, you know, Trump has always said, you know, we're going to win. I mean, he never says, you know, this was one big misunderstanding during the election campaign. People understood him to be saying that we were going to withdraw from all these wars, that we were not going to engage in, you know, that we were going to be isolationists, build walls and withdraw to our homeland, and that was going to be that. That was never what he was talking about. He was talking about, quote, winning. And when it comes to terrorism of the type that is practiced by the Taliban in Afghanistan or ISIS or Al-Qaeda or whatever you want to talk, however you want to define it, that is just not, quote, winnable, at least in the way he seems to think that it's going to be generally, you know, turning over his sword at Appomattox. I mean, he seems to honestly believe that that can happen. There will be a VT day where we declare that it is over in Afghanistan. And I don't think there's nobody in his administration with an expertise, to the extent there are any, and certainly the military people have some expertise in this, that understand it that way. That is just not going to happen. So I don't think they've gotten anywhere with him on this. I don't think he understands what he's into and what's been happening. And to the extent that he was saying in years gone past, complaining on Twitter about Obama, I've seen lots of newspaper articles over the past week sort of going back, now look, he's flip-flopped. Back in the day, he was against war, and now he's for it. That's not the case. He was trolling Obama. Or before that, he was even trolling Bush. This is Trump. It has nothing to do with strategy. It has nothing to do with philosophy. It has nothing to do with his understanding of policy. That's just, he trolls. He is a troll. That's what he does, and that's all he was doing. When he got into the White House, he was faced with the same thing all these presidents are faced with. Afghanistan is a quagmire of quagmires. It has been for centuries. We're nothing new here. You know, the historians were talking about it long before any of us were alive, about the attempts over the centuries to occupy Afghanistan and to somehow change its trajectory into something that it isn't. It is a very, very, very difficult problem in and of itself. Set aside the greater problem of Islamic terrorism around the world. So, you know, this, and now look at who we've got in charge. I mean, we have Donald Trump. It's mind-boggling to think that this is someone who's going to be making decisions about this. But the fact is that this is not something, Afghanistan is not a quote, solvable problem in the sense that we might want it to be.
Right.
So here we are with Trump making sort of vague promises, and you know, and he did poke a stick at Pakistan. That was kind of slightly scary. We don't need Trump meddling in with nuclear powers anywhere. I think maybe we need to keep him away from that. So that might have been something we might have thought twice about. But other than that, you know, there really wasn't a whole lot that he said anywhere that was in any way a real change in direction.
The only thing that I would add to that is that, and it's two things. One is, of course he's going to change his position on this, like he has on literally every other thing he has discussed at this point, right? I mean, on Medicare, on healthcare, on infrastructure, on all of it. I mean, he's on all of it. So I'm surprised at the level of surprise that's generated. The other thing I would say, he did say we're going to unshackle our military.
Yeah.
And we know that in terms of Syria, in terms of Iraq, in terms of Yemen, there has been a specific policy change that we will not mitigate civilian casualties in the way that the Obama administration had required. And we have seen the results of this in Yemen. We have seen the results, and to be fair, there's more activity in Syria and Iraq, but we have seen the results of this in all three of those countries. There has been significant rise in the number of civilian casualties that we have committed, essentially. And it seems like we might have that in Afghanistan as well. But Digby, we're out of time for this segment. If you'll join us in the next hour, we've got a lot more to talk about. I'm Sam Cedar. This is Ring of Fire Radio. We'll be back with more later. Just ahead, America's lawyer, Mike Papantonio. I'm Sam Cedar. You're listening to Ring of Fire Radio. I know the score at the back of my head. Them other boys, I don't give a damn. They kiss on the ring. I carry the crown. Nothing can break me down. Folks, the Ring of Fire is sponsored by JustCoffee.coop. That's JustCoffee.coop. If you like fair trade, delicious coffee, tea, or chocolate, head over to JustCoffee.coop. Use the coupon code MAJORITY and get 10% off. There's free shipping. You have no reason not to get this great coffee. It's a great outfit in Madison, Wisconsin, which supported the protests there. JustCoffee.coop.
Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. Our next guest needs no introduction, but he's going to get one anyway. Joining me now is co-host and author of the upcoming book, Law and Vengeance, Mike Papantonio. So, Pap, as I was saying before we got on air, I am very excited. I am headed on vacation. In fact, tomorrow morning it starts. I'm going to the beach. And I got to say, I want to talk to you about Abilify. I also want to talk about what's going on with the theories behind holding opioid manufacturers accountable. But I got to say, I'm sitting here with a copy. It is a it is an edit proof only because it's not out yet. But I have my Law and Vengeance copy, your second book, a thriller, a legal thriller that I am going to be bringing to the beach, and I'm psyched to read it. And you know, I'd love to talk to you just a little bit about themes because I've interviewed people who, you know, talk about these themes that take place in real life, the failure of our government to prosecute white-collar criminals, and then simultaneously the problem of our government pursuing whistleblowers, particularly under the Obama administration, in a way that we haven't really ever seen in this country. These are themes that you bring into to Law and Vengeance.
Yeah, I mean, the whole idea of the book is when I started doing the series of books, this is number two in a series of four books. The third one is about the opioid crisis, and the fourth one is about banks washing money for terrorists. And so this one, and they all, by the way, are centered around actual cases that I handle and our law firm handles. But this one centers around a true case. It was a manufacturer that made a gun sight, both for pistols and rifles, that unfortunately was a disaster. It was defective. They knew it was defective. They actually, the gun sight would work in perfect conditions. It would work, but if you put it out in the heat, humidity and heat would cause it to be off several degrees every 100 yards, and a lot of people were, you know, it cost a lot of lives because of it. So that's a case we handled, and it builds around the same characters that came out in the first book, Law and Disorder. They just are onto a different case now, and this one's a little the severity and the threat and the danger is really turned up in this because it involves a police union who is mandating the use of these and in the process of getting kickbacks. And it involves one of the biggest weapons manufacturers in the world. So Nick DeCotomas and the characters in that book are under pretty heavy pressure. Gina Romano is the key trial lawyer in that. She's a experienced white-collar criminal defense lawyer, and so she's been thrown in the middle of this case because a couple of her partners were killed. So I think it's a story you're going to like, Sam. I mean, hopefully you'll read it. The goal of all these books is be able to read it and then come away after you read it being entertained, but also learning something. For example, you mentioned the Department of Justice and what a miserable job they've done actually going after, taking care of whistleblowers, and B, really throwing anybody in jail. I mean, it's one thing to fine a multi-billion-dollar corporation, you know, fine them $500 million. They made that, you know, in a month.
Right.
And these are multi-billion corporations. And the Department of Justice has evolved into this thing to where unless you don't go to jail unless you're wearing a hoodie. If you're wearing an Armani suit, if you're wearing, driving around in a Bentley and have a Rolex watch on, you don't go to prison. You simply pay a fine for your fraud, for your crime that results in the death of human beings. But if you're wearing a hoodie and you're out on the street selling a couple ounces of marijuana, baby, you better hold on because you're going to prison.
Right. I mean, if you play cards right, maybe they make you Treasury Secretary instead of prosecuting you for for running a foreclosure
a scam,
a mill. I mean, let me ask you this: I want to talk about Abilify, but is there a certain amount of liberation for you? Because I know there's a lot of cases that you have. I've spoken to obviously a lot of attorneys. We go to the Mass Torts Conference twice a year, and I speak to a lot of attorneys about a lot of these different cases. And sometimes when they settle,
or sometimes they've seen things that are sealed that they've seen in discovery. Is this liberating for you to be able to talk about things? Obviously, you can't tell the exact facts, but you can talk about dynamics that must be that you've been probably, I would imagine, you tell me, dying to articulate.
Yeah,
to the public.
It is. That's an excellent point, Sam. It's not just when you try a case and get a remarkable result, and even though the bad guys don't go to prison, you're able to tell the story to the public if corporate media takes time to actually cover the stories, which though they so infrequently do. They if they give it two or three paragraphs, it's usually not enough. But yeah, it is liberating because these books allow me to talk about the intricacies, for example, of the Department of Justice that people come away with the Obama administration, for example, thinking, oh, well, Eric Holder was great, or Loretta Lynch, she was really one of us. Well, no, they weren't. They were just the opposite. They have nothing in common with you. They have nothing in common with the typical American. Eric Holder comes from Covington Burling, for example. He ran the Department of Justice, and he always sided with white-collar criminals, both when he was in private practice, and he's back with the same firm, by the way, now defending white-collar criminals again. But when he was Department of Justice, it was so dysfunctional because he would be in front of the camera and everybody said, oh, wow, Eric Holder fined the company $250 million, and wow, that's spectacular. Well, no. Often was times that where companies actually made products that killed people. They made a pharmaceutical that poisoned a liver or a kidney or a heart, and people died. And so you've got him, or Wall Street that stole money from mom and pop pension programs. And Eric Holder would say, "Well, we really hit, we really hit J.P. Morgan, baby." Well, no, the people lost everything. They lost their entire life savings. They committed suicide. They became ill to the point to where their lives never recovered. And so we think, oh, yeah, he was really one of us. No, he wasn't. And neither was Loretta Lynch. And Obama knew exactly what was going on because those are the people that really supported him. And so, it is liberating to tell these stories in the book because, you'll take a progressive that may read the book and all of a sudden they're going, wow, I didn't know all that. Well, it's the truth. And so I think all these books that I'm writing right now, you mentioned, Abilify, that's a story that you almost can't believe. It's a story where the company it's a case that's pending right now where, the company, the documents say we whitewashed the clinical data. We whitewash the story, and the story is that the drug is so powerful that that affects the impulse center of the brain. And we have cases where people that have never gambled in their life all of a sudden show up on an Indian reservation gambling and have literally gambled their entire, everything they own away, including their house and their car. Those are not uncommon kinds of cases. And you know what? They admit it. I mean, Abilify, the manufacturers now, they admit it over in Europe. They warn about it over in Europe that the impulse control problem is a disaster, but they don't in the United States. And so but that type of conduct, that was Bristol-Myers Squibb that handled that,
right,
that case. But that type of conduct from corporate America is not an exception anymore. It's the norm. And so it's fun to write those books because of that. The next one I'm working on is the opioid crisis. I mean, think about the horror of
Pat,
that.
I want to take a break and I want to talk about what is happening in terms of the opioid crisis. There has been some measure of progress in some respects. In other respects, a lot of these companies still have not been held to account. And I want to talk to you about the possibility that we could see some legal principle developed or some mechanism to mitigate the damage and to compensate the states and individuals for the damage that this overprescription, the way this was manufactured and distributed, if we see a similar dynamic to what we saw in regards to tobacco. We got to take a quick break. We'll be right back. Mike Papantonio. I'm Sam Cedar. This is Ring of Fire Radio.
My foolish pride, long before I see the
We're back on Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. Right now, I'm catching up with my co-host, Mike Papantonio, who's been working on a lot of key, crucial, important cases around the country. So, Pap, when we broke, you were telling us about your book, Law and Vengeance, which is coming out shortly. I think people can pre-order it on Amazon right now. It is the second of four of your legal thrillers. And the parts that I really enjoy about it is that, you know, having talked to you, having talked to a lot of the attorneys who work in the same field as you do, sometimes for public consumption, sometimes, you know, just some off the record type of stuff, that to read these stories that I know are at the very least, you know, founded and developed out of real stories that you have come across is fascinating. And, you know, I want to talk, I have a couple more questions about Abilify, but particularly I want to talk about the opioid crisis. But you said something at the end of the last segment that I want to pick your brain about. And that is, you've been practicing this type of plaintiff law for decades now, and you've gone after some of the biggest companies in the world, if not the biggest companies in the world, who have created products, who have distributed products, who have sold products, who have committed offenses against the environment, all basically to cut corners so that their profit margin come off and they can sort of push these externalities onto society. Has it gotten worse? Has it gotten worse? I mean, are these corporations finding, because there's less accountability at places like the Department of Justice, let's say, that they can get away with more, and they're just making a calculation, we may have to spend $400 million worth of fines, but that's okay if we're making $4 billion worth of profits.
Yeah, it's worse than that. They say this, we're going to calculate that, for example, we have dumped opioids onto the public arena knowing that what was going to happen is what we call opiate was diversion. We knew there were going to be pill mills. We built it into our business plan. We knew there was going to be a drug trafficking. We built it into our business plan. We knew that this whole list of things, we knew pharmacies were going to be overprescribing. That's part of our business plan. And so understand, they do the calculations. They know, for example, McKesson paid in excess of $100 million a fine. They were one of the distributors. The big three are McKesson, Amerisource, and Cardinal. All of them have paid $100 million or more in fines for doing these things. But you know, so what? They made $6 and $7 billion a year. So how does that hurt them? There's no harm done. There's no harm. So they're able to build.
That's just like basically, that's just another line item on their budget, right?
That's exactly
what it is. We got to pay for trucks. We got to pay for fines.
Yeah. When you look at the finances of most of these big corporations, they just write it off as a cost of doing business. Now, there's the other part of it, though. The other part is, how about the human lives that are lost? Now, right now, for example, I'm going after the distributors, those three distributors I just mentioned. I'm going after them on behalf of the cities and the state, and the cities and the counties. Now, I am not handling the AG cases. This is not a tobacco. This is not a repeat of tobacco. This is a different approach. I handle tobacco, as you know, and I don't. I think in the end, I don't know that the money actually ended up where it should have gone completely. Here, you have a county, for example, that lost $120 million because of the opioid crisis, where they had to have extra hospitalization, they had to have extra ER, they had to have extra police, they had to have extra dependency court problems where, you know, used to be 5 children a year were taken away from the parents. Now it's 80 children a year because of the drug problem. So they had all these costs that were built into this opioid dump. Okay. The distributors, here's what's so amazing about this story. The distributors in 1970 were assigned the role as the gatekeeper. They were the people who were supposed to be the gatekeeper. They were the people, the one who were supposed to make sure this didn't happen. And they were given special licenses for that problem. Well, So year one and year two, it's very obvious that it's happened. As soon as they start selling year one, year two, they take a look. They're selling in year one, they're selling about $150 million worth of the opioid. Year two, it's $400 million. And then what ends up happening is they start seeing what's happening. See, their argument, Sam, is that this wasn't foreseeable, that all we are is a distributor. Gee whiz, we didn't do anything wrong. We didn't see this coming. Let's go ahead and give them that for year one and year two. But what about year three, four, five, six, and seven, where they're making $6, $7, $8 billion a year, and the opioid crisis is so bad that heroin has come in as the tail of the crisis? In other words, opioids come through, people get addicted, heroin comes through, those same people that got addicted on opioids are now using heroin. So this problem is not over. I mean, the opioid crisis is not yesterday's news. It's happening right now in places like Ohio, in West Virginia, Kentucky, Alabama, all of these cities that used to be Pleasantville, USA, are now regarded as zombie land, Sam. They literally, there's a vernacular out there, and that is, we created a new zombie land in Columbus, Ohio, wherever it may be. And so the problem is so pervasive. And understand, here's another example of government saying, oh, well, we're going to fine the heck out of them. Well, you know, $100 million fine doesn't mean anything. At some point, Sam, you got to start putting CEOs in prison.
Right.
And then culture changes. Then they say, well, you know, Uncle Joe did this with his company and he went to prison. Maybe I shouldn't do this with my company.
I mean, it really is stunning. And the devastation continues to mount. I mean, to this day, we're seeing elevated mortality rates. We're seeing increasing overdoses, and it's like you say, it is destroyed communities. And this is when we talk about externalizing, you know, the social costs for profit. That this is a perfect example of it, right? I mean,
oh no, you can't get a better example. You can't get a better example. They didn't care. Look, they've made all their money. They left town. Now they've left zombie land behind, and now the heroin and meth producers, they're in big time. There's a city down in Mexico called Jalisco, Mexico, that is become part of the industry. They bring in black tar heroin, and they count on following the demographics of the opioid distributors. In other words, they know, okay, they've
it's
been
a
here.
Roadmap. They can look at what the course. Distribution numbers are in different states and counties and
of
whatnot
course.
And say, this is where we go.
This is where
right
we
now.
Go.
This is where our market. This
let's
is
go.
Our, this,
let's
is our
go.
This is basically a, you know, a market report, essentially.
Yeah, let's see who's had the most overdoses. Let's see where there's the biggest problem. And understand, let me throw one other thing real quickly. The salespeople who work for these companies like McKesson and Cardinal, they live right down the road. They see the headlines every day. They hear the newspaper. News reports every day. They hear the radio spot every day. They drive by the pill mill every day. And they want to say, oh, gee, we didn't know.
Yeah. Well, Pap, thanks for updating us on that. And good luck with that case. I want to hear more about it as we go on. And I will give you some feedback on Law and Vengeance, which I intend to dig into as soon as I hit the beach, hopefully in a couple of days.
I hope you like it, Sam. Take care.
Thanks,
have a
Pap.
Good time.
Pre-order Pap's latest book, Law and Vengeance, over at Amazon or Barnes & Noble. You can learn more at lawandvengeance.com. When we come back, Heather Digby Parton will join us to analyze more news from this past week. That's just ahead. I'm Sam Cedar. You're listening to Ring of Fire Radio. Make sure you check out ROFpodcast.com to support the show by getting our podcast.